Hey, everybody. We're back with another commission podcast, back on the commission grind. We have a bunch of commissioners to thank. This is another community commission where a multitude of Bald Move fans came together and bought shares in a project to share the load. So say they all. The commissioners are Jay Nothing, Has Corners for some reason, Russo. Which I think I already like spoiled what it's going to be. It's Battlestar Galactica.
Oh yeah, I mean the title. We write titles on these podcasts.
We do.
You clicked on
it's
it. You know what it
box.
Is. No. Corners on what? What is his name?
Jay Nothing Has Corners for some reason, Russo. I don't know if that's a Bald Move joke. I don't know if that's
no.
A wire
it's a Battlestar
reference.
Thing. So like in Battlestar, the corners, for lack of a better term, are chopped off of all the documents.
Oh.
So they're in like this weird hexagonal, like extended hexagonal kind of thing.
It's this future.
But I take issue with no corners because I just think they doubled the number of corners. They're
true.
Just weaker corners.
That's
like
true.
You have less of an angle, but you have more corners.
That paper is made out of unstable protomatter, and if it had just four corners, the whole thing would blow. Jeff, Anubis 21, Cleveland Punk, Manoj, Matt from Boston, Devin from Maine, Ben from Ironwood, ISD. Now I'm starting to try to divine people from usernames. LSD5U or maybe ISD5U.
Okay.
Depending on how trippy you want to be. Sam N, Leap Lizard, L Stinger, Shinson 90, Jeffrey W, Inquiries, Shane, the Bowman, and Nick Honesty. Now, these people all took a pretty big risk. Or maybe it was the last thing left in the store during the Save Bald Move campaign, and they're just chipping us in money. But I did put a warning that, like, I really don't... I noped out of this at the end of Season 1. Mm-hmm. And I sat down to watch it in the winter of 2009. So I think the show is already complete.
Yeah, it was.
And I started watching it, and because you spoke so highly of it. And in fact, I think we watched a lot of the episodes together. But
I think maybe Caprica had already been canceled by then, too.
Could be. But I started having problems with the show, and it just like big problems, which then started leading to a bunch of nitpicking, which, you know, that's my greater theory of suspension of disbelief. Like, once that threshold has been crossed where you no longer, like, suddenly things that otherwise you would be like, oh, you're a fucking nitpicker, become, like, the biggest issues in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to say that this show is well made. It does a lot of things right. There's a reason that lots and lots of people like it, and it filled a probably important hole in the science fiction gap at the time. Because I'm trying to think back in 2009 what was going on in the science fiction fandom. Like, Star Wars was in a bit of lull, right? There was no, like, maybe, I don't know when J.J. Abrams' first Star Trek came out, but, like, you know, there wasn't certainly a lot of stuff, good stuff on television. So... It's obvious why people like this. It's obvious why a lot of people like this show. Is what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to make nice, everybody. Yeah, well, 2009 is when this first Star Trek came out. So I feel like this filled a lot of you know, science fiction shaped holes in people's hearts. Mm-hmm. And you really like the series.
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan.
And you've seen the whole thing.
I think it's especially at that time, I feel like it's an important show, not just for sci-fi, but for, like, human beings. Because I don't know if you remember this, but George Bush was president at the time, and we were dealing with the war on terror and all that that encompasses.
Well,
and
in 2009, when I started watching, we'd begun the nightmare era of Barack Obama.
Okay, yeah. This was in 2004, though. So.
Right.
It was quite a while before that when I was watching it.
Right.
And I think it had a lot to it. It's interesting because in my mind, okay, so this is Ronald D. Moore's show, right? Mm-hmm. Who was a producer or writer on Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. Like,
Next Generation.
Controversial figure in Trek fandom because he's
right.
One of the ones that kind
and
of DS9, put the stake
right?
through the heart of the Roddenberry, hopeful, optimistic exploration era and ushered in the grim dark Star Trek of Deep Space Nine and Voyager.
Yeah. And you can very much see, I would compare this to Star Trek, but it's all those things that you just said. It is more, I guess, nuanced and realistic than a Star Trek series would ever be.
Right.
And I think it's important because it kind of, in my mind, takes a lot of issues and doesn't give you a clear-cut answer on a lot of stuff, but it encourages you to think about it, which I always think is some of the best stuff.
It's also aspirational in a different way from Star Trek because...
It is.
Like, Star Trek is essentially perfect humans.
Right.
What I noticed in Battlestar is you don't see any, like, sexism or racism, but people still swear, they drink, they get angry, they punch each other. Women punch men punch women.
Yeah, they make mistakes.
It's like, but no one is necessarily inherently better than anyone else. So it's like they've got, it felt more of an evolution of human beings rather than someone just completely taking the pineal glands out of humans,
right,
which Star Trek sometimes feels like at times.
Which makes a lot of sense for this story, I guess. But it's also, it's a world that doesn't kind of, I guess, whitewash the consequences of people's actions. Mm-hmm. Like, it has a very firm memory of what people decide to do and kind of runs with the consequences of that and makes people pay the cost for it a lot of times. So to me, that's one of the things that sets it apart from, like, a utopian Star Trek vision.
Right.
Is that idea that people are going to do bad things. And especially when it comes to, like, the characters that you're supposed to love and hate. You're not supposed to ever hate anybody on Star Trek.
Yeah.
Except the very bad guys, right?
Yeah.
Like the evil, you know, Khan or whatever. Yeah, you're supposed to hate him. Or the Borg. You're supposed to hate them, but you're never supposed to hate Riker.
And even the Borg, they'll bring in a cute Borg.
They'll
bring a lost little puppy Borg or a super hot Borg and try to humanize them because that's what Star Trek does.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, you know, you're not supposed to hate Riker.
Whereas there are times in this series where I hate every single person.
Right.
And there are times where I love every single person. Like, they're flawed beings. They're trying to do the best they can to survive. And I think not just from a military perspective, but from a societal perspective and personal.
Yeah, and I will say that's another thing that I think the show does really well is its characterizations and the relationships between them feel really and ground, and it's one of the strong points of the series.
Yeah, far more so than like a Star Trek. Like the writing here, I think, is much better than any of the Star Trek series I've seen.
Sure.
Okay.
All right. I also like...
those are a lot of things I love about it.
I also like the fact that in Star Trek, religion is something that other cultures experience.
Right, and we look down on it as kind of all these silly primitive cultures.
Kinda, but also, like, you can't, like, Picard won't just be like, ha ha, you're fucking sky gods, like...
Right, but he's got the prime directive holding them back.
He
feels unleashed from that.
Yeah, when he gets on r/atheism,
right,
he just is a fucking asshole. But I like in this world that they still, that's the thing. Like, we talk about this in the Leftovers podcast a lot. That, like, I'm not sure that religion is something that humanity will ever outgrow, because it seems like religion can adapt and change the times to as long as humans die, they'll always need a way to grapple with that, you know, cosmic unfairness, the fact that we are this intelligent matter that can comprehend our own existence and comprehend the end of that existence. And that's, I don't know, it just doesn't feel like that's something that the evolution kind of equipped us to deal with, because by the time we're getting old enough to feel our mortality, we've already, you know,
we've served evolution's purposes and had
and given all the children we're going to give, and our genes are done with us at that point. So coming up with ways to try to make meaning and find purpose in a world and a universe that has none, you know, religion and metaphysics seems to be able to fit that bill, and religion will change and grow over time. I mean, you can see that the Catholic Church we have today is not the religion. Well, I mean, this is probably super controversial to Catholics, but it's literally not the religion that was what I think that Jesus left on the cross. You know, a Jewish reformation movement. And the same thing, like, you know, everything you can say about Christianity past Catholics is just, you know, more splinters and more change and more evolution. And, you know, Baptists today are not the same as Baptists were 100 years ago, et cetera, et cetera. And I like the fact that instead of in Star Trek universe, everyone's essentially a warm and fuzzy agnostic atheist. You've got, you know, if you, you've got people that are agnostic and atheists, and you have people that are very much believers, and you've got sometimes problematic intersections of politics and religion.
Yeah.
And I liked it because, like, that's something I feel doesn't get talked about in an honest way a lot. The fact that if you're a sincere person of faith, you know, a lot of times we talk about this in like, well, you shouldn't impose your views on others. But if you're a sincere person of faith, it's going to inform your worldviews in ways that, even if you're not talking about imposing your faith on others, if you feel, if you feel like there's a eternal reward if you act this way, that's going to influence who you are and what you believe.
Sure.
You know? And I do think there is a little bit when you look at some particular American foreign policy, a lot of that foreign policy is informed by a particular branch or interpretation of Christianity. And I don't see how you can tell people to ignore that.
No, I think it's foolish to ignore. Well, you're not saying that they should ignore the fact that politics is influenced by religion.
Well, right? What I'm saying is, like, if I was an evangelical Christian politician,
right,
how the hell can I put all of my feelings and what I think of as my eternal creator wants me to do, and how that's going to affect you know, my life and my eternal future and my family's eternal future, and perhaps the fate of the world?
Mm-hmm.
How can I put that aside and just, you know, deal with something on a case-by-case issue? So it's like,
yeah,
on the other hand,
the show is so good at conveying those two. They're not even two sides, they're just two different kind of perspectives of approaching the same problem.
Right. On the other hand, it is also horrific to be someone who doesn't have that same value and belief system, to see someone looking like they're driving a car off a cliff for blind faith. And unfortunately, and I don't want to talk too much about it because I want to stick on the praise mode. The President Rosalyn character is that Thelma and Louise character for me, where it seems like she's always trying to hijack the car and drive it off the cliff to Adama's kind of more rational, trying to keep the car on the road and do what needs to ensure humanity's survival.
Yeah, and actually both of the Adamas, like Lee and Bill?
Yeah,
Adama,
sure.
They both at one point or another are kind of the foil for Rosalyn.
Right.
And I kind of like how their relationship with her changes over the course of the show.
Of course, I can't speak to that because I stopped watching at the end of season one.
Right.
And then I actually watched the first episode or two of season two on my commission rewatch here. So I've moved the ball another yard or two down the line and then fumbled and fell on my dick and broke it.
Okay.
And don't really want to continue, but
that's a shame because I think, like, season one is just the setup for stuff that gets so much more interesting.
There are so
and better.
Many great big ideas in this series.
And the stuff that you're talking about that you like, in large part, happens later on. Like, the politics and the religion coming up against, like, science and faith and justice and what that means and how you, like, I talked earlier about the terrorism thing because there's a segment of this show that deals just entirely with that from the opposite perspective. Like, if you are the, I guess, oppressed society here, and you're feeling like it takes our heroes and it puts them in a situation where they resort to tactics that we would view as terrorism,
right,
in our modern day society. And how do you feel about that? Like, And the thing I really appreciate about it is it kind of weighs the pros and cons and the good and the bad of it, you know? Nobody goes into it. The show doesn't approach it from this one perspective. Mm-hmm. Every character has a different idea about what they should do here, and everybody argues it out, and they express all the different sides of it.
Yeah.
So I feel like whatever your views are on science versus religion, on faith versus, you know, justice and politics and all of these things that are wrapped up kind of like on top of each other, you are gonna get something out of this show, and there's gonna be someone for you to root for and someone who can kind of connect you with the other side of it. And I think that's one of the most interesting things that it does, whereas Star Trek will kind of just sit back and say, here's the right answer.
Right.
It's messier than that, you know? And in that way it feels more real and it feels more grounded, I guess. And it's not quite as aspirational, but I think ultimately it ends up being that because, you know, everyone comes together in the end and can kind of learn to live with each other. And that's where I think it's aspirational.
So I want to, I don't know, if you want to talk about some other strengths of the show and things you enjoyed, we can do that. There's a couple of things I like some big picture ideas that, that I admire about the show and or I thought was exciting that we can talk about.
I have a lot of like specifics. I have like some big moments of the series that I really love.
All right. Well, I feel like you should go and then I'll chime in when necessary. And then there'll be a point in the podcast where I can then pivot to talk about some issues. And I'm going to try to keep it to first principle things because I'm going to try to tell you the things that kept me from engaging. And a lot of these are very personal to me and the mm-hmm. point in my life when I was watching the show. And I'm going to try to not engage in like some petty nitpicking. I might nitpick a little because, you know, there's got to be some people that feel like I do. And also, there's some of these episodes that I felt were so close to being truly great that the flaws seem extra silly and magnified. You know,
okay.
Like in a movie like Crank, mm-hmm. what the hell is even a plot hole?
Yeah, if you're nitpicking in that movie, you're doing it wrong.
Right, but like if in the middle of There Will Be Blood, if Daniel Day-Lewis walked into a scene with his dick hanging out.
That might be intentional. And
did like the Charlie Chaplin kind of like umbrella twirl with it.
I'd be asking, what does it mean?
And for 30 seconds, and then he came back at the door and came back in, and it was Daniel Day-Lewis again. You'd be like, the fuck? And that's all people would talk about when mm-hmm. they talk about it. So,
yeah.
You know, that's but I want to stick to the positive stuff because, you know, people paid money for us to commission this podcast. So they don't want to hear me just.
Let's talk about the acting. So I think the first string actors here are really, really good. Like you've got Edward James Olmos, who, in my opinion, like he has such a powerful stoic performance this show.
He does have gravitas.
Yeah. And that's kind of his MO, you know, from all the way up from Stand and Deliver. Like he is this very silently charismatic and powerful person.
Plus, he looks like, just by virtue of his craggy ass face, he always just looks like a guy who's been through some shit.
Oh yeah.
So you know, if he puts down what he's doing and he like takes his reading glasses off and he fixes you with a stare, it's like, do I really know what the hell I'm talking about? You know, this guy's been through 50 of the situations I'm trying to criticize him on, so maybe I should shut the hell up. And that's what you need out of an admiral type character.
Absolutely. Who has the worst face? All apologies to Edward James Olmos, but who has the worst face? Edward James Olmos or Tommy Lee Jones?
I mean, Tommy Lee Jones worked himself into it, where I feel like Olmos just had a bad... He just had really bad acne.
Sure, yeah.
Like, he's got the Scarface type of thing going on. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Olmos had to deal with it longer.
That's true.
But he made it work for him.
Tommy Lee Jones came by it honestly, though.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, that's just gravity and the ravages of time.
Yeah. Okay. So I think that Edward James Olmos as the anchor of this series is super impressive. I mean everybody loves Starbuck, right? It's hard not to love Katie Sackhoff in this show.
No, it's so funny because like before I watched the show, I didn't get everyone's rabid fandom of because usually when that occurs. In a science fiction show, it is because the person's like, you know, super hot. At least I'm going back into the less enlightened times of my life. And I'm like
Seven of Nine, right?
Like,
nobody really likes her character.
Right.
They like that she's hot, which is not the case here.
And And when I watched the first couple episodes and you see like because like I said, you see a headshot of what do you say her name
Katie Sackhoff.
Katie Sackhoff. It's like, okay, well, yeah, she's a woman. I get it. Uh-huh. But it's a combination of like she's got like a light switch that she can turn on mm-hmm. that makes her super engaging. And I think the character that is like this tough, you know, hard drinking, hard smoking, hard gambling, hard fighting, hard fucking mm-hmm. fighter pilot, a traditionally kind of like, I guess, masculine role. I think that was intriguing to a lot of people. And she did it extremely well. And the series doesn't even take like I don't know, maybe there are they play with the gender bending of the Starbuck character. But like mm-hmm. I found it refreshing that this like, nope, that's like, yeah, Starbuck's a woman now.
Right.
And that's the change, and they don't really make a big deal out of it.
Oh, but fans of the time made a huge deal
out of it. Well, they still do. So that doesn't surprise me.
They still do. Yeah, but I really like, you know, just how badass she is.
Like, if they rebooted Star Trek Next Generation right now and William T. Riker was Wilhelmina, fucking up in message boards up in flames.
Yeah. I think they should swap. They should reboot it, and they should swap Deanna Troi and William Riker.
Sure.
And just gender bend both of them.
Right. Put Jonathan Franks in the teal dress.
Oh, no, don't put him. Put him in the seat.
Yeah. Put him in the teal dress.
Get Marina Sirtis with a beard
put
and
her
a mustache.
Put her in the beard and the high collar.
Oh, Jesus.
Fuck her, have her do the tunic tug all the time. I want it. Yeah, that's what I want to see.
All right. So she's great. And I think maybe the surprise of this, he comes into the series kind of just looking like a pretty boy, but Jamie Bamber, he plays Lee Adama, can eat some fucking scenery.
Yeah, I found him a little stiff at first.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
He kind of started warming up to me. Like,
and there's some truly great stuff between him and Adama.
Yeah,
or he is an Adama. Yeah. Between him and his father. I really love that stuff.
Yeah, their relationship, they're kind of complex and stormy relationship. Like, I was watching the 2-part cliffhanger at the end where they're like, there's a part where they're sparring or boxing.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, what an interesting father-son relationship where they're just like, I can't even imagine, like, if you have even a little bit of fire in a father-son relationship, that boxing would be a good idea.
Uh-huh.
And it's not, because Adama puts him, Commander. He's not even Admiral. He's Commander, right?
Yeah.
Why did they do that?
Because there was an Admiral already.
But, like, if the fucking 74th person in line to be the president can be called the president,
right. Yeah.
And not, like, acting president or provisional president or shitty president until we can't find a better president, then why can't the commander that survives become the Admiral? Like, if you're the captain of a vessel who is in charge of a fleet of other captains, you're a fucking admiral.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Or a commodore.
At the very least.
Yeah. But you're not... commander.
There's another admiral who shows up later, but...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So does he get a promotion? Or is that just Rosalind's way of tweaking him? Is he actually admiral and she just called him the commander to, like, piss him off?
I mean, I think his status would probably be
admiral. I can't think of anyone
that
referred to him as commander other than Rosalind.
No, I think everybody does.
Like, really?
Yeah, okay. Just maybe not in the episodes you watched.
Okay.
But no, he's pretty much commander all the time. So he's great. I think the guy who plays Tyrell, the engineer or whatever, the crew chief, I guess. Is what he is.
Chief, uh-huh.
The guy who plays Tyrell is on and off great.
Uh-huh.
And also on and off, eh.
Uh-huh.
Just okay. But, yeah, they do a lot of interesting stuff with him later on.
He's the Cole Meany of the show.
I don't want to get to the negative stuff yet, so I won't quite talk about Roslyn. But, yeah, he is the Cole Meany of the show.
Mm-hmm. But the Chiefs,
Chief
man.
O'Brien, yeah.
The Chiefs, they're just...
I mean, they're an archetype for a reason.
Right, yeah. they're steady, middle-of-the-road
mm-hmm.
rocks that you can build on. Not maybe known for their Emmy Award-winning acting.
Yeah, I think some of the shakier ones are maybe the dude who plays Hilo, Grace Park, who plays Boomer. I don't always like their performances.
Interesting, because I didn't see anything wrong. I see what you're saying about Helio. And then just like Star Trek, there's a steep-ass drop-off once you get out the main cast. Like,
absolutely.
Anytime there was a dude of the week who is going to go and try to get a med kit and get himself shot up, you're just going to suck. You're just going to be some good-looking guy they pulled out of a lineup, and this is your first... that's what I felt like. Now, also... Dr. Baltar is an interesting character.
Oh, shit, is he ever. Yeah.
Because I really enjoyed the way they continued to make his talking to the Phantom of Six and the people in front of him be relevant, like the dialogue and kind of the way, same way Archer.
Yeah.
I always marvel that Archer, 7 seasons into it, can do the same damn thing where the line in one scene ends and another character begins with the continuation of that line or the response to that line in a completely different scene, and like they continue to do different transitions. Like that's a level of difficulty that I would think would be hard to pull off. It's a gimmick that, like, once you commit to, it's like, oh, it's albatross around your neck, but it continues to be fresh and funny. I thought I just really enjoyed it where he's trying to have these twin conversations, and it gives him a little bit of an off-kilter, like, manic energy, which I think works for his character. But I also really dislike the continual Fantasyland sequences. Those things just seem like they drug on forever. Like when Six would take him into fucking, what was the first planet got killed? Caprica?
Yeah.
Like Caprica Heaven for a while to do some exposition with him and do some sexy Cylon stuff. Like it's,
right.
Man, every single time the lens went soft, focusy, and gauzy, and it was just those two. I'm like, ah.
Yeah, and that's all the faith and religion and like what it means to be human stuff that I'm not quite as interested in.
And I guess one of the things that eventually develops is the Cylons too have a religion and interpretations of prophecies that are I guess human prophecies.
I mean, I guess they would have to be.
What is the thesis of this show? Like, what does it end up with? Like, the humans and Cylons are the same? Are humans and the Cylons are symbiotic? That they're going to form a new joint coast? Is that, I feel like that's where they're going.
I mean, the overall thesis of this show is, like, basically everything that is everything is locked into these cycles, and there may be some way to change it, but it's almost like a freak occurrence.
Like a Matrix-y kind of thing?
Or it's trying to say, like, humans have the capacity to change if we want to. I'm not quite sure, because the ending of this show is very strange.
Hmm.
I don't know. I can kind of try and explain it to you, but I'm not sure that
go for it.
I'll do a great job of it. Because I don't know if people are aware of this, but the show came out in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
It has been since, what would be 4 years later, 2008, mm-hmm. since I've seen any of this show until mm-hmm. yesterday. So my memory is a little hazy on it. It's 14 years gone now. So as I remember it, the end of this show is essentially humans and a certain faction of the Cylons land on what is our Earth,
mm-hmm.
150,000 years in the past, and kind of plant the...
They're still wearing single-breasted suits and
seeds
ties.
Seeds of civilization.
100,000 years in the future.
100,000 years in the future?
Did you say that? Oh,
what
they went 100,000 years in the past.
In our past, yeah.
Okay.
So they land on our planet 150,000 years ago, and they see us in our kind of primitive form, our tribal form, and they decide to kind of break the cycle. They're not going to set up like cities. They're just going to kind of live as nomadic tribes people and kind of do right by the Earth. And then they cut 150,000 years in the future, and you see modern day New York or something, mm-hmm. modern day cities, and you get the ghost of Baltar and
Six
talking about how all of this stuff is repeating. Like, look at the technology, look at the decadence, all of it's repeating again. But then they do this thing where, like, shit, I don't quite remember, but it kind of zooms in and shows you that the robotic stuff is happening again. Like, it ends on this montage of, like, Ibos
mm-hmm.
and shit, where you see a bunch of robotics happening, and I guess it's encouraging to question, like, what will we do with these robotics? Will we change the cycle? Will we enslave this AI race again?
Uh-huh.
Or will we kind of set it free? Which is one of the things they do at the end of the show, is they decide to set all the Centurions free,
right.
and let them go live their lives.
Right. Well, that's the interesting thing, I think, about that implication of the AI enslaved, is because it's... I mean, it seems like it's going to be a fact that if we do have a sentient AI, its initial state will be one of servitude.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, is your car...
Right.
Your car. If your car is thinking, it's a slave. You get into it, and it has no control of where it goes, or what kind of care and maintenance you give it, and what schedule you do that in. Like,
yeah,
you know, you talk about smart cars, and, like, I mean, I don't know whether we set out to create the first like human level intelligence or it happens emergently, but, like, it's going to be a piece of property. So it's curious to frame that as, like, oh, are you going to enslave? Like, it's more like, do you grant an alien consciousness the same rights that you grant yourself? Like, will we ever get, when that time comes, will we do, I guess, the right thing?
Yeah.
I mean, this is all...
That's what I said. But
okay, I'm sorry.
Roughly.
I'm sorry. Anyway.
Not the same words.
It's weird that Because I thought where they're going is that maybe there's going to be a Cylon human hybrid.
Oh, there is, yeah.
Race that
there totally is.
That becomes the thing that surpasses them both and is like the.
Well, they're hoping
like,
that humanity will be that because we in this series are the product of a human Cylon hybrid.
Oh right, yeah, we would.
Yeah, because there's a baby. There's Hera.
Does that mean I have a Cylon transponder inside me?
I don't know. Is a transponder hereditary?
I mean, yeah, okay. I'm starting to, I almost started a nitpick, but uh-huh. I can't do that yet. Okay, all right. So us modern humans are human Cylon hybrids.
It's weird because we are Earth humans mixed with humans from Caprica and Cylons from Caprica and this new human Cylon hybrid from Caprica.
Right.
But we are Earth humans. Like they do this whole thing about like what are the odds that humans would have evolved in two different places to be, you know, essentially to be able to breed together.
Sure, sure.
And so I guess we're like Earth humans plus Cylons plus Caprica humans.
Right.
I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah, no, I read a story once. Oh shit, it's fan fiction. Oh, it's really bad. An interesting idea about like the reason that there's humans in the Star Wars galaxy is because there's some kind of time portal fuckery that marooned essentially a rebel outpost on ancient Earth, and that's why you have humans in the Star Wars galaxy as well as the Milky Way. Hmm. So I know that's a cool concept.
Yeah, and I like kind of what they do with the religious stuff at the end is they kind of use it as a motivational force to get humanity where it needed to be. So like,
can I ask you why? So the thing, I guess, yeah, who created the was the religion cynically constructed to bring about this event? And I'm going to keep using the Matrix as a...
Yeah, it's hard to say.
Like, is it architected so that when something, a particular event happened, these forces would come together to make this thing occur? Because that makes a lot more sense than... It just so happens that some ancient drugged-out prophecy led to something that actually happened in the future.
Well,
does that make sense?
My guess is that the humans and Cylons on Caprica were created basically through a very similar or the same process as the humans on Earth. Like they were evolving, and then this other race of or other planet worth of humans and Cylons and technologically advanced people came and instilled their myths and their legends into that culture, and that kind of just perpetuates because there's this very cyclical idea within Battlestar Galactica where all of this has happened before, all of it will happen again. It's
what's the mechanism that keeps it? Is it the religion itself? Is the mechanism that keeps it happening?
It's almost like a universal. Like they frame, or a lot of people in the series frame God as like a force that doesn't necessarily have like good or evil in mind. It's
does
more
it,
just
does
like
it bind us and surround
similar,
us.
Yeah. No. It has like a purpose, but it's unknown. You know, it's the standard, pretty standard, like Christian. Oh, God works in mysterious ways, sort of thing.
Right. Right. Okay.
It's really difficult to explain, and I don't fully understand it because I didn't give it a lot of thought because I'm not that interested in that part of the show.
So why do the Cylons follow the human religion? Because we created them and they just have that kind of baked in?
They kind of don't. So it's interesting because it kind of flip flops what humans today think about a singular God for the most part. And kind of how our ancestors were with many gods.
Right.
So humans believe in the many gods. And the Cylons believe in one God.
All right. I
don't know how to piece this together for you because I don't get it myself.
Okay. All right. Because the other thing I guess I was asking is Starbuck a Cylon? Does it turn out she's a Cylon? And my other question is knowing the...
Fuck, man.
Because here's the other thing. It's like I am also a huge unironic fan of this Battlestar Galactica board game.
Okay.
Because the mechanics introduced into the series make a really compelling hidden role. Like when you've got Cylons that know they're Cylons trying to fuck shit up. You got Cylons that don't know they're Cylons and are working as humans until midpoint in the game when they're secretly revealed to themselves. And now they have to start working as a Cylon. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of that, and that stuff is very flavorful. And the fact that like you're using like human lives become a resource. like that's tracked like a NASDAQ fund that rises and falls, and not a resource like to generate capital, but like a resource that must be preserved and protected and husbanded to keep alive the human race. And you've got that food and fuel and population and all that stuff that you are. Every decision you make burns one of those resources. You have a limited amount of raptors that you can use to scout systems, and it's really cool. Unfortunately, it takes forever to play and has led to a lot of bitter recriminations. And I found that the core secret role mechanic is just as easily done with Resistance and Secret Hitler, and you can play a game every 15 minutes and no one gets too butthurt about it.
Yeah. So let me shelve the Starbucks stuff. I think that's interesting because in the show, certainly you're aware of this. They have like the board where they write the number of remaining humans, right?
Right. A little eye rolly that they're tracking this on a whiteboard, but sure.
Well, yeah. I don't know. So that's interesting. Like they have, it's essentially like they start off on a ship that's about to be decommissioned because it's so fucking old.
Right. But that turns out to be one of their greatest strengths because it doesn't have the vulnerabilities.
The network computer systems that allow it to be hacked easily and shut down and destroyed. So I find that is an interesting, I guess, reflection on the status of humanity, like being able to put a number up there and say we're doing good or we're doing bad based on that number.
Right.
It really gives a sense of urgency to the show and to every decision they make throughout it and how it affects what they view as the final, bastion of humanity.
Yeah. Because the other thing, just apropos of nothing, is that I thought they were going with a little bit of a new school, old school feel, even though Adama himself is old school.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Rosalind's ship, and like in the episode 33, which is, I guess, the pilot episode, the first episode of the series, it's not the miniseries.
It's fucking, real stupid the way they did
that. But she's tracking the 33 minutes on a fucking analog clock with a torn up post-it note at the 33. Everywhere else in the fleet, it's all high-tech digital counters.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's got a whiteboard that she's manually tracking a number. I just wondered, like, if they're, like you know, she's whipping out an Abacus and shit. I wonder if that was to show, like, her, like, homespun, earthy, you know, life hack style way of doing business versus Adama's like button down military precision kind of way.
Maybe.
Anyway, the reason I ask if Starbuck is a Cylon, is she a Cylon?
I don't think I can answer that question. Here's what I'll say. What I'll say about Starbuck. They leave it very vague, in my opinion.
Interesting.
Starbuck has a large role to play in the, I guess, new formation that humanity takes on Earth. She at one point finds her body on some planet, and I don't remember where it is, but she finds her dead body somewhere.
Well,
which
she's absolutely a Cylon.
Implies that she's a Cylon, but there's so much trippy shit going on in the show that I cannot say for sure. And you could have the Cylons, because the Cylons are fucking with her constantly throughout the show. So what's real and what isn't, I don't know, but she definitely finds her body.
Huh.
But we never see another copy of her. It's not like we see 15 copies like we do with Cavill or something.
Well, I was
right?
wondering, like,
we see her and her dead body.
Like,
and that's
when did
it.
Boomer become a Cylon? Were any of the Boomers
episode
not
one,
Cylons?
The end of the miniseries, I think.
So they actually turn her into a Cylon there.
Oh no, they don't turn her into a Cylon. She was a Cylon from the beginning.
So that's what I'm saying. Like before she even boarded the Galactica, she was a Cylon. Was she ever a human?
No.
So they put these baby Cylons in with humans or switched them at birth or something. And
I don't think they're babies. I don't think they're ever babies.
So they were just like all those memories. Obviously not the memories of Starbuck, but like any of her pre Battlestar memories are just implanted or fabricated.
Yeah. It seems like they have some technology to either wipe your mind, of certain things and erase your memories or implant memories in it because all of these, like, Final Five don't know that they're Cylons until they know.
Final Five, you use that as a, like, a Fab Five kind of way. What is that?
It's the Final Five who haven't been revealed. So, like, throughout the series, they're kind of revealing, oh, this person's a Cylon and this person's a Cylon.
Do the humans know there's five left that they haven't been revealed?
No, but we see, like, well, some of the humans do, I think. Like, I think Rosalind has a vision of it.
Of course.
Where she sees, like, five of them or they themselves do. I can't quite remember.
Right. Yeah, Rosalind.
But yeah, there are five that are kind of like left up in the air.
Huh. Do they explain why, instead of having a bunch of unique copies of humans, they roll with so many copies? Like, I got to the point at the end of the first season where a million naked boomers come out and give the little the boomer Omega or boomer Prime a pep talk and send her on her way and then get vaporized. I'm like, wouldn't it be much more effective to have just every Cylon be an individual, unique human? Because then it's like,
yeah,
you know, once boomer's been burnt, like, her value as an infiltrator goes down, you know, to almost nothing.
Sure. Yeah, I probably would have. I imagine it's a budget thing or something. I don't know.
Okay, so I'm going to say, was there any kind of, like, attempt to explain that?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right.
That's just kind of how it is. And it has this weird symmetry between, you know, the 12 colonies and the 12 Cylons, and I don't know if they ever play with that, but...
Okay.
12 is a significant number.
All right.
In Battlestar.
Does this Arrow of Apollo ever do anything? Does it actually...
That's like the haziest part of the show.
Because that's like...
I
was laughing because, like, you know, this is the thing that's supposed to be the key to finding Earth. And at one point, a Starbucks starts, like, beating six with it. Like using it. And I'm like, oh, shit, I hope there's no, like, delicate technology in this ancient arrow or some kind of, like... Because you're using it as a fucking bludgeon, like a club. But, yeah, she gets it to President. It's like, well, this would have shown us where Earth is, but repeated blunt force trauma has rendered it inoperative.
Now, Starbucks' journey, I guess, is the cloudiest to me. At some point, she's, like, imprisoned in a farm, as they call it, where they're trying to create human Cylon combos, and they're bringing women there and trying to impregnate them. I don't remember.
Huh.
I don't remember.
Interesting. Maybe it's because we're trying to get out of the only having 12 faces.
Maybe.
We got to discover genetics. We have to discover sexual reproduction, guys. All right, everyone, let's try this. Let's rub penises together. No, it doesn't work. All right, try the vaginas. It's still not working. What are we going to do? how do they do this, you know? We've rubbed them together fast enough, they started a fire, and there's still no babies.
It's amazing how technologically savvy they are, but they just really know nothing about human reproduction.
They really don't. They don't. The other thing I thought was a big idea, it was kind of cool, is the idea that the resurrection, especially like the fact, because the reason I thought it was a little dopey that the Cylon spaceships were biological in nature, because like...
The Raiders, yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, you know... in my view, as a futurist, if I could shed this meat sack and go into a purely synthetic body that had superior functionality in every way, like, why the fuck would I ever go? It'd be almost like, you know, if there was a class of humans that have figured out how to transfer to consciousness into robots, and then later they're like, you know what, we want to go back into the meat sacks of fart every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the idea that you would have... a biological starship rather than the same consciousness inhabiting a artificial starship. But the one thing I do like about, you know, regardless of the biotechnology, the fact that it resurrects, what a huge advantage that is to be able to like, you know, think of like our best fighter ace pilots, you know, they are the survivors of several victorious missions, but then if they die, you lose all that. But what if like an ace could resurrect 100 times? They get shot down 100 times and every time they get back in the cockpit, they're that much better.
Yeah.
Like that's contrasting to the humans where, you know, they lose a Viper pilot and they lose a Viper pilot.
Yeah.
The Cylons just get stronger and stronger and stronger.
Yeah. And the series does a really good job of playing with that idea too.
Like, does it?
The big problem that becomes a huge problem for the humans because not only like can they not kill these Cylons in any kind of important way, but they also every time a Cylon infiltrates, it's like this ultimate recon mission, right? Like a Cylon comes in, learns a whole bunch of shit about the humans. If they kill it, it just resurrects at the base and they get all that
knowledge. They have all that knowledge.
Right. Yeah. So what they have to do is kind of keep from killing these Cylons while keep them at bay. Also, and it becomes this really interesting like push and pull between like should we kill this
thing? Wait, are you
thing,
saying that Cylons are not constantly connected to the Cylon? It's only when they die.
Yeah.
What kind of Okay.
I don't know.
All right.
This is,
right,
this is a sci-fi show.
I'm not going to nitpick. Not going to
nitpick. It's a sci-fi show with a lot of technology that's like, how do they do this?
Yep.
I don't fucking
it's magic.
Know.
Gotcha.
It's also, yeah, a little bit more magic than like a Star Trek.
Okay.
Like it doesn't come down to like Heisenberg compensators.
Right.
It comes down to, it's fucking magic. Like, for instance, the Gaius Baltar 6 connection.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some hint in there somewhere that Six might have put a chip in his brain, or she makes a joke about it or something.
I just assumed
but
Baltar
I don't know what the
was
fuck
also
the connection
a Cylon.
Is.
He didn't ever do it. And
he's not.
She activated him somehow.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Interesting. Okay.
Maybe he is. I don't remember it that well. Maybe he turns out to be a Cylon, but...
Or you've got a religious sci-fi element. Maybe she just has a soul.
Right.
And, you know...
That's what I'm kind of getting at, the magic part.
Right,
of it,
right, right.
That
it's
they
more,
don't ever explain.
It's much
they
more
just
Star
say,
Wars than Star Trek.
Yeah.
In that way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I don't know. I mean, like, if people have answers on this stuff, I'd love to hear them, because
right.
Battlestar still remains kind of a large question mark to me.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
All right. Well, what else you want to talk about?
As far as like the really good stuff,
just whatever. I mean, whatever you think if you had a fellow Battlestar fan in here and you want to talk to them about the series as a whole.
Oh shit. Well, I would talk about very specific things.
Because you have a few
things.
Thousand in the room with you right now.
Like, I would talk about the trial of Gaius Baltar and the stuff leading up to that.
They finally realize he's some sort of a double agent, and they actually put him on trial.
Is he a double agent? Yeah, he is, I guess.
I mean, yeah.
In the full context of the show, it's hard to say.
Ah.
It's really fucking hard to say, because I don't know what's directing this or how it's being directed, but it becomes murkier as the show goes on. So I think the trial of Gaius Baltar is a really interesting thing. So basically what happens here is the human beings find this new planet. I think it's called Kobol. I don't quite remember. But they decide to settle there.
Mm-hmm.
And they do so. And then like a year later or something, the Cylons come back. So they think they've evaded him. But a year later, the Cylons come back. And they essentially like look at this primitive group of humans who are barely scraping by. Everyone is sick, everyone is hungry and cold, tired, starving, and they come down and they say, all right, Gaius Baltar, here are your options. A, you surrender and we enslave all of humanity, or B, we kill you. And Gaius Baltar decides to surrender. And then,
is he the president at this point? Because he's the vice president.
He is the president, yeah.
When I stopped watching. Okay.
Yeah, he's elected president, Rosalind which is also cool
Rosalind
twist.
Dies, yeah? Because she's got 6 months to live when I stopped watching.
No.
Really?
Spoiler alert. She does not die.
Okay.
Well, she does die. Just they wait a very, very long time.
Okay. Is that because the whole series takes place in 6 months? Or
no.
It's a Walter White kind of thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Walter White
kind of thing is the whole series takes place in a finite period of... A time.
That's true. Yeah, they do give him a decent timeline. But yeah, Roslyn overcomes the odds.
Okay.
Beats her cancer temporarily, and it comes back and kills her eventually.
Gotcha.
Where was I? Oh, yeah, Gaius Baltar surrenders to the Cylons. So they enslave humanity, and a whole bunch of bad shit happens to them. They're worked like horses. Ty goes off on some crazy terrorist thing.
Why the fuck would a robot race enslave humans?
This is a really good question. I don't know if they're like experimenting with the idea of enslavement.
Or is
like
a portal like,
enslavement.
Oh, how's this feel? Like, stop
exactly.
It. The centurions just take turns grabbing the human's hands and like, stop hitting yourself. Stop hitting you. Like, you know.
It might just be payback. I don't fucking remember. But
yeah.
So Gaius makes that decision for humanity, and bad things happen to them. And then when they're eventually rescued by, you know, Adama.
Because that's the other thing. Like, the Cylons have way more numbers, too.
Tons more, yeah.
Okay.
And they're essentially immortal. So
it does seem like enslaving
do?
Humanity is more of like a dick move than it is a resource grab.
Right.
Or some kind of economic stimulus for the Cylons.
That's all I can remember is that it's just kind of, fuck
it's you. It's just material for the Cylons hit new show, so you've enslaved the civilization.
Right. Entertainment gets weird when you're an AI.
It does.
So Gaius, when Adama comes back and saves them, Gaius is put on trial for essentially selling out the human race. And I have never... So what they're doing here is they're showing all sides of it, and I get that. But I have always had this visceral feeling of injustice when I go into this, looking at what Gaius has done. And I think Gaius is a shitbag. Gaius is the biggest dickhole of the human race.
Me too.
He's a pompous, self-righteous, self-important...
Shallow.
dickbag.
Yeah.
Hate everything about him for the most for most of the series, but I don't think he was wrong in making the choice he made. And the show eventually, like,
well, yeah,
ultimately comes down on my side, and
death,
I'm glad it
death
does.
Death versus enslavement, you always
that's not a choice. Not a choice.
No, it's not. You always choose the one that preserves hope.
Right, but the thing I love about the show is they don't just paint that in black and white. Mm-hmm. And I have always, like, I get this visceral feeling of anger when people start pointing the finger at Gaius and say, you're an evil person because of this action. But it's such a cool way to kind of show how everybody is going to react differently to this. And not everybody is going to be level-headed. There's
going to
be emotion involved, you know, anger. Like,
right.
My family went through all this shit because of the Cylons, you're the easiest person to pin this on.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it because I feel bad about everything that happened.
Yeah.
And I want to try to get back to some normalcy. I want closure, and this is how I'm going to get it.
Yeah.
And
I don't know. Maybe
I
death
thought
is,
it was
maybe,
super
maybe,
interesting.
Maybe death is preferable to... So I guess I always think of like entering into slavery as like a temporary condition that you wait until the time is right, and then you recover.
Well, it turns out to be just that in the show.
You recover from it. But like, yeah. I guess if you're talking about like an unbeatable, super powerful AI, the idea that you would be able to... It's almost like monkeys going into the zoo. All right, mm-hmm. We'll go in this cage, but God damn it, as soon as we got our enough stones, bananas, and poo,
uh-huh.
Our time will come. It's like, no, it never will. You're going to live and die in the zoo, and you're never going to get out.
Mm-hmm.
That's maybe death is preferable. I don't know.
Maybe, but, you know, they do get out in the show. So, the monkeys escape the zoo.
There you go. They finally got enough rocks, poo, and bananas.
But that trial of Gaius is one of the high points for me in the series. I think the election of Gaius is also, like, a lot of this stuff centers around Gaius because I hate him so much.
Mm-hmm.
It really made me feel, you know, angry and emotional and, like, all the things that the show is trying to get me to feel.
Did it ever feel that some of these trappings of democracy felt very strained? Like, there's one point
in this, like, desperate scenario, or...
Not just a desperate scenario, but just, like... There's this one point that made me laugh out loud I forgot about. I was watching the two-parter season close, and Adama's like, you just fucking took this military option that I was going to use to nuke this base star and get my people back, and you've sent it to get some goddamn holy artifact.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes to depose her. And she goes, and he's making these, he's not even really threatened. He's like, oh, you know, I'm going to take over. This is a military coup. And she's like, oh, the press is here in the room with me. And Adama's like, my God, the press, hang up the phone. I'm like, there's 47 fucking thousand people that are on ships that, and you have the monopoly of force.
Uh-huh.
And you're afraid of what the fucking last fleet of mankind times is going to say about it? Who gives a shit? It just seemed ridiculous that he would give that much credence if like he's talking about we're talking about the fate of the last 47,000 people,
right?
In the war, and he's talking about a press scandal.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was preposterous, but I know why it's happening, because obviously Ronald Moore is wanting to make a lot of allusions to present-day politics and stuff like that, and you have to have all these different organs of state, and you have to have elections, and you have to have that. But I felt like it kept striking me as silly in this particular situation that it's almost like, mm-hmm. imagine the Titanic goes down and there's two lifeboats left. One, the captain's on one, and fucking the unsinkable Molly Brown's on the other. Somehow she becomes a president. And when the captain says, hey, no, this is bullshit. You can't be president. This is stupid. She goes, well, there's a reporter on board,
mm-hmm.
and he'll tell the other lifeboat what you're doing.
Right.
Like, it seems farcical. Like sometimes the universe is so small, but it has the trappings of this big universe that it seems silly.
Well, I think that the idea here is, so Adama is an interesting character. The larger idea here, I think, is trying to figure out what humanity is now that they've been more than decimated. They've been taken down to 47,000 people.
Right.
Like, what does it become? Does it become a military occupation because survival is the most important thing? Or is there something essential about their society and their humanity that they need to hold on to in order to preserve the spirit of the people to
right.
get them through this, you know?
Right.
Like, there's a delicate balancing act that I think Adama is doing throughout this series that he kind of comes to very early on. It's maybe in the miniseries where he's super pissed about this school teacher being the president and like making a call that he would never make.
No, I understand.
And then he eventually comes around to like, okay, I understand why you try to do these things for the people.
I understand the
idea
that
he's a complicated character, especially because
that you want to preserve democracy and you want to, you know, because that's I get all that.
Even if it's just for the morale of the people that you need to see you through this, right? But Adama especially is a weird character because a lot of the times they will portray him as having a very firm feeling on a thing and a very pig-headed style, but then he always kind of comes down on the right side of it. So like you'll kind of in some instances think, man, he really swerved on that fucking thing where I didn't see it coming. Mm-hmm. The trial of Gaius is one of those things where he's very adamant that Gaius Baltar does not even deserve a fucking trial. He should be beheaded in the public square. And he's a judge on the panel. But in the end, he votes for the acquittal of Gaius Baltar because the defense made their case and the prosecution didn't. Like, it's really hard to predict what Adama's going to do, and I don't know if that's good or bad for the show, honestly.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's also a worthy thing to explore, is that when you're dealing with an existential crisis, do you abandon all of your ideals? Do you, like, when is it acceptable to, like, engage, as you said earlier in the podcast, acts of terrorism?
Right.
You know, when can you stop using quote-unquote legitimate methods of war and start attacking civilian populations and applying pressure that way? And is that effective? And even if, you know, that's the other thing, is like you abandon your principles and it still doesn't work, then what? Those are all kind of, I guess, valid things to explore.
Yeah.
Is there anyone that just is like a son of a bitch? Because I feel like that's the other thing that... Rosalind seemed like she was maddeningly one note on the other side. And Adama, as you said, even in the miniseries, was kind of like, originally I thought it was going to be, oh, well, this is going to be an interesting struggle between civilian government and or military leadership and civilian oversight and ultimate, you know, command authority that they have. But then you're right, like, Adama kind of straddles that middle ground where he's like a Cincinnatus type where he'll assume complete military, and he has complete military control, but it's like, oh, okay, I'll let the civvies have a say. Who is a son of a bitch? Maybe it is Ty, because
I think Ty is the closest.
He takes over in earlier in season two, and like clearly it looks like they're going to explore a little bit of his more rough spun sense of leadership
I mean, Gaius is the biggest son of a bitch.
But he's not the son of a bitch in the way I'm like, who's the guy being like, why the fuck? Like, we have all the guns, we have all the bombers, we have all the resources, and no one can stop us. So if we think we're right and this is what's saving humanity, then why the fuck don't we do it?
Yeah, I think that's Ty.
Okay. All right. He gets his eye shot out, so apparently... That's the thing. First thing Hulu showed me was a picture of his eye shot, or a picture of him wearing a patch. So things don't go entirely his way.
It's not shot out, but
oh,
yeah.
Is it?
He loses an eye, certainly.
Is it cancer? The goddamn cancer?
It's the cancer of the eye. Yeah,
well,
the
I mean, as much time as they spend
cavity cancer
in radiation areas and shooting up anti-radiation drugs, like I imagine that
and
the rate
up
of
getting
cancer
hit by nukes.
Yeah, I imagine the rate of cancer is like 99.7%. You know, they're going to have three-eyed babies and tentacles and all kinds of shit. It's going to look like the underworld of Futurama before too long.
Yeah, there's a... So, I say, like, oh, Adama is this level-headed, and I understand Rosalind for the most part, but, like, there's some stuff early on where I feel like they haven't quite established their characters as strongly as they need to, where characters just make really stupid decisions. Like, Rosalind's decision not to jump away from the civilian fleet... I think it's maybe the end of the miniseries or the end of the first part of the miniseries. Yeah, where Adama thinks that Lee is dead because the ship goes off the radar.
Right.
Her decision not to jump away is a completely stupid one.
Right. Well,
for absolutely no reason.
Her flip-flopping on the Olympic carrier situation was about to make my blood boil.
Yeah.
Like, she fucking gave Adama the ultimate decision to make that, said it's the right call, and then when it's time to do it, she started dragging her feet like, I don't know. I mean, come. And, Yeah. The thing that drove me especially nuts is if you want to tell that, then maybe give us any kind of indication that Adama might be wrong. Mm-hmm. But when they have Starbuck and Grande Latte Cappuccino do their slow flyby of the Olympic Carrion, it's completely empty. And it's not responding communications. It's barreling towards the fleet with nukes armed, and the mm-hmm. And the president's still in her quarters. I don't know. It's 1,300 people. Like, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, I don't quite understand that. And that comes back later. And Adama should have said,
well, too bad. You already gave me authority. Push the button. You know, like, right. It's like that stuff drove me fucking crazy through the first part of the series.
Yeah, with good reason. I don't understand. Like, when you see there's no people on board. Yeah,
I
mean, that's the thing, like, people
I thought, because I, in
it's
fact,
a big ship. It's a big
in fact,
metal husk.
As I was watching this unfold, it's like, oh, what's going to happen is Starbuck and Apollo are going to fly by, and there's going to be families, and there's going to be little kids waving to them, and they're really going to put the screws to the situation. And in fact, I because I'm like, there's no way it can be this stupid. Mm-hmm. But when they drove by, and there's like, I'm like, oh, this is just this is why I fucking stopped watching the show.
And they should have. They should have done that. And yes! It should have been clear that these families were hostages.
Yes.
You know, like they should be screaming and clawing at the windows when they see those Vipers drive by. Like, save us, save us.
Yes.
That decision becomes much tougher.
I don't understand why they made it. Like, if you
the
want...
decision to blow up a husk of metal is not a decision.
Then the president saying, well, wait a second, makes more sense. But it's like, to me, that feels like self-inflicted gunshot wounds. Sure. Those are, that is Daniel Day-Lewis whipping his dick out for 30 seconds mm-hmm. and doing a Charlie Chaplin inexplicably.
Yeah.
Like, that should have been a glaring oversight in the writing room. It should have been a glaring oversight when the script came back. When they're doing the effects renders, like there's, you know.
I'm not actually sure that I haven't misread that entire situation because later on in the trial, in the trial of Gaius Baltar, Lee gets up on stand and he says, "I have done really horrible things," and one of the things he cites as being incredibly terrible is destroying the Olympic carrier.
What the fuck?
And I'm like, if there was nobody on the Olympic carrier, why is that a problem?
Right. And if the Olympic carrier was going to ram into the fleet and explode all of its nukes,
right.
Destroy all of humanity.
You're a hero, not a villain.
This is just like we talked about in Dr. Strangelove, where like it sucks to be on those 41 bombers of loyal U.S. servicemen that are just doing their job, but your 41 times, what, 6 lives versus 100 million?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you're going to have to die.
That's where, you know, that's one of the instances where the show kind of fails you. But
and why Strangelove, a farce, did that scene a lot more poignantly and accurately than goddamn Battlestar.
But I think there are many, many, many other scenes in this show that do it so well.
Right.
And completely make up for any, you know, for the minor quibbles that you would have with that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, that idea of the greater good is a constant throughout this show.
Yeah, and it should be.
And it absolutely should be in this
scenario. And I'm just saying, like, I just feel like... I what I guess is I'm trying to paint that I'm not, like... Obviously, I'm not a science fiction hater.
I was really
excited to sit down because I'd heard so many things, and I was really excited to sit down and watch this show. But I kept finding it throwing barrier after barrier to my engagement with the situations to have characters that... The situation's called for, like, a really complex moral discussion and debate with reasonable objections on both sides, and they continued to refuse to have that and just, what I felt like, set up the president to always look like just an objectionist, pig-headed, stubborn, slap Adama on the wrist just to let him know that you're in charge kind of character.
Yeah, so... Here's one gripe I have with this show.
By the way, if you're a Battlestar fan, it's going to and me talking about my problems is going to piss you off. You can probably because I think this is the pivot. This is the pivot where I start talking about why I'm not a Battlestar fan.
I mean, I have a lot of other good stuff that I want to say about this show.
All right,
that we'll get to, but I do want to pivot because now's a good time. This show has a weird feel to me. Now, I think there are moments in this show that you can look at and say, "What the fuck?" Mm-hmm. Like this is a baffling decision by this character. A lot of the times when I feel that way, I look at it and I say, yes, I feel that way, but what does it do to the larger picture, I guess? It shows a perspective that maybe I hadn't – that maybe hadn't been injected into the conversation yet. And it's unfortunate that it comes from a character who I view entirely differently from the way the show is using them right now. But it's an important point that needed to be made. And this show has a tendency not to linger on things at all. Like, they make the decision, they execute it, they get out. Mm-hmm. And I think when they're going for such, like, a big scope of conversation and a big scope of viewpoints, doing that in, like, rapid fire and kind of cutting between all of these people who are making different decisions for different reasons on the same issue, it has a weird feel to it. I can't ever quite wrap my heart around it to say that I love this thing exactly as it is, but it does feel like it has some kind of effect, like positive effect overall in the show. It gives me a feeling that I haven't felt in other shows, which is almost like I want more, but you've kind of already said everything there is that needed to be said about it. So there's no reason to really give me more.
Right.
It always kind of leaves me wanting a slight bit more out of the show, and that's probably one of the reasons I love it so much, is because I never grow bored of it.
Yeah.
It continues to move forward, maybe a little bit faster than I'd like it to, but always forward.
Right. No, that's like, you have always talked about how the best way a show can leave you is like when you walk out of a really good restaurant and you've had a really good meal.
You're not overstuffed.
Like, I'm not, I am full and this is great and I want more, but I'm just going to get sick.
Yeah.
What I need to do is go away and get hungry again and come back and something. But like, you know, an infinite buffet with a funnel that shoves it down your mouth is, well, I mean, now you're talking some kind of weird Cylon breeding and feeding program that surely they explore in season four. The uncomfortable thing, I guess, so I was watching this and like, you know, when I first watched Battlestar, I don't think I'm a critic now, but I certainly wasn't a fan with a platform and a megaphone to talk about it. I never really did much introspection about why I like or didn't like things. And now that I have to defend these opinions, I spend a lot of time. And as I was making my notes on the first season, I had this uncomfortable realization that I think if I right now sat down, like if Star Trek The Next Generation came out today, I would have run so far away from that show so fast.
Because it's just not up to the quality standards?
The season one of Star Trek is terrible.
No, it's bad.
And like
The Next Generation you're talking.
Yeah, Next Generation. Mm-hmm. Which is one of my all-time favorite shows, and grew and matured, and even then, like with its, you know, with its episodic content, I still probably wouldn't have. But a fundamental shift has happened to me since when I was a 12-year-old, 11-year-old that got really into Star Trek: The Next Generation, and now I was looking for reasons to like something, especially if it's a science fiction show, like, oh shit, here's this robot and he just effortlessly lifts this boy out of a creek that's also a fake holographic creek. That's fucking cool.
And there's a holograph like prison below it or something.
And there's this starship just broke into two fucking pieces and it's got a battle mode and a civilian transport. That's fucking cool. I want that and you know, like, and the fact that Captain Picard is summoned to a cosmic kangaroo court that this like higher being is going to judge him on, it's like, those are cool concepts. The fact that the central plot is heavy-handed and Saturday morning cartoon and thin and bullshitty, because I wasn't looking for reasons not to watch the show. I was looking for reasons to invest and keep watching. And nowadays, I tend to look for reasons not to watch a show because there's so much good shit in it. Why would you waste your time with something that's not perfect or something that's not at least perfect for you?
Sure.
And that sucks. I'm like, well, shit, if I'd have taken that attitude in with me to Star Trek, I'd never become a Star Trek fan. And that's a huge part of my life. So I don't have to. So everything that I would say negative about Battlestar, just know that it goes 10 times more for things like Star Trek and Deep Space Nine that I have a great deal of affection and would defend, you know, to the nth degree on an internet forum.
Yeah.
But
yeah, no one will argue that. Some people will argue maybe, but I certainly wouldn't argue that Battlestar Galactica is not a better show than Next Generation.
Right.
I think it's a much better made show.
The other thing is, so there's a lot of things peculiar to my background. I already talked about the fact that as a newly minted, out of a fundamentalist Christian cult, agnostic heading into atheist, it was very tough to watch President Roslin, who I don't think they did a particularly good job of making her seem well-reasoned or rational or, like, you know.
No, I mean, that's the point.
And also,
of her,
the thing is, like, I was
she's not that rational like Adama is.
Also, McDonald, President Stands with a Fist.
Yeah,
I don't
Mary
know
McConnell.
That I don't know that I even enjoy her performance, because I felt like some of this stuff was written in a way and then she got it and performed it with maximum smugness and conviction, where Adama always plays stuff with like a slight doubt. Like, he's certain of his convictions, but he's also like
he plays it like he's considering the other option.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Whereas President Rosalind is always right, and yeah. The stuff that I've seen, I never get to see her kind of hoisted on her own petard, or like, oh my God, this is a... You know, even after...
Well, this goes to the idea you were talking about earlier, that humans will always have some kind of religion.
Right.
Because it's you when you have faith like that, you can be assured. You can just blindly walk into that and say, yes, this is absolutely right, because there's nothing to prove you wrong.
Right.
That's the thing about it. Like, that's a question that
and
science
can't
really
touch. And even if
you're
wrong, you weren't wrong. You just misunderstood the prophecy.
Sure, yeah. It's very easy to course correct in that, too, sure.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the viewpoint she's coming from. So yeah. I get that part of her performance. I just don't know that I like Mary McDonnell as a performer.
But I just want to emphasize how, like, one of the core problems of Jehovah's Witnesses is they've been tricking people to enslaving themselves this religion on the promise of a paradise to come since 1867.
Yeah.
And every fucking time they predict the end of the world, they're always wrong. They did it in the late 1800s because they're an Adventist shoot-off. They did it in 1914, they did it in like 1933, they did it in the 60s, they did it in the 70s, they did it again in the 90s, and I became aware, as like, I'm just the latest generation of suckers, and I immediately yeah. sit down to watch this science fiction show, and I've got this political character who's blindly following prophecies, and you yep. can see how, like, I'll just use the word triggered, like, that's yeah. just a white hot fucking knife in my skull as I'm watching this. And then if that character yeah. plays it not with doubt or humility, but with maximum smugness and moral certitude, it really was hard for me to watch. The other thing is that I was a huge Tom Clancy fan. Like, gritty military realism is like, I like that. I like a very realistic depiction of that kind of world. And I pay a lot, and I've read a lot of good military fiction, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And this show, I feel like a lot of people give it credit because it throws a lot of military jargon, but there's just fundamentally silly things. Like the episode 33, it's ridiculous that they've done this 237 times and they're still doing ready room briefings mm-hmm. in between the sorties.
They acknowledge that.
Yeah, it doesn't help. It doesn't help when on 237 Apollo says, shit, I've done this 237 times. Just do the same thing we've always done.
You think it should have been on the 13th time?
Yeah, like, that's the thing. Like, everything is just like fucking...
Here's the problem I have with 33. I'm with you.
Because like
I think
this could have been like day two. And because the other thing is like... No human being, and I kept on thinking as I was watching this episode, like, well, they're on some kind of futuristic stims.
Mm-hmm.
But then Apollo goes and orders her Starbuck to take stimulants on the fifth day of no sleep. Like, maybe 1 out of 10 pilots could maintain some kind of effective combat readiness with this adrenaline for 5 days. But a whole fucking ship and fleet full, it's ridiculous. This should have been, like, going on the second day where people are running out of gas. And I just feel like... They got the trappings of accuracy, but, like, no one has actually asked someone, like, what's the longest a fighter pilot could stay at combat readiness during World War II?
I did a Google search on how long can you go without sleep.
Uh-huh.
And 5 days is obscene. 5 days
it
is obscene.
Is.
So
it's ridiculous.
Here's the thing. I think 33 is an amazing, amazing episode that
yes.
sets up the desperation and the tone of this
yes.
show in an astoundingly good way.
Yes.
However, I'm with you on that. I think they should have gone 2 days. They should have gone 2 days and maybe like 50 jumps, something like that.
Yes.
It would have made a lot more sense, and it would have felt... I think what they said is, okay, we know that you can do this for 2 days. The audience doesn't know that. Let's amp it up. Yeah. Let's say, like, what's the longest you've ever stayed awake? Oh, shit, I've stayed awake for 38 hours.
Uh-huh.
No problem. I felt bad, but yeah. I could have gone probably another 12. No yeah. problem. Yeah. They're like, fuck that. We're going to go double and say that these people are superhuman.
Right.
And that the and think about how much worse you would feel at double that.
But think about how much, and they're doing.
But it's just not humanly possible. Like, people can stay awake for 11 days, but you're basically dead.
Yeah, and also the equipment. They're doing combat where they're essentially crashing into the carrier every fucking time.
Yeah.
And they have, like, what, 12 Vipers?
It's, I mean, like, hallucinations start at day two.
Yeah, I mean, just the human and mechanical breakdowns. It's just, yeah. It's completely silly, and it took me completely out of the action. And it's a lot of, like, George Martin gets into this problem, too. Like, you know, it's a battle of 100,000 people versus 100. Like, it's just, and when Rosin said it's a straight face, how do we lose 300 people? You lost exactly 300 people? How the fuck did you lose exactly 300 people?
That's the bigger question. Not how do we lose those people, but that number.
300
of people?
Not 301, yeah. not 307, not 363, not 290. Like, 300, just yeah. exactly 300 people, huh?
Yeah.
Like, it's little things like that. Now, granted, I would have rolled my eyes a little bit, but had not the central drama of the Olympic carrier gone down the way it does, mm-hmm. those would have probably been things where, like, well, gee whiz, that was a 90% episode that – or that was a 97% episode. It's now an 85% because of, like, just, again, self-inflicted gunshot wounds because Ronald Moore wants to make this super fucking gritty and
right.
super hard-boiled and ridiculous. But then – I felt like the way the president responded to the end and the way they staged it just brought it down to like an A plus idea with D execution, and it's like a 65 for me.
Uh huh. Yeah, it's a shame.
And then all those things too, like the admiral on day 5 of no sleep is taking the time to fucking shave himself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean. Why
not day 4? Like, why are you letting it grow so long, Admiral? If you're trying to keep up appearances.
I assume that he shaved every day, but, like, really? And the other thing is every 33 minutes? Like,
right.
like honestly, the Cylons coming every 3 hours would have been unsustainable.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got to be 33 minutes. 33 minutes for the Admiral to leave the bridge, go take his shirt off, fucking shave. It's just, I don't know. It's...
Okay, that seems like an arbitrary thing to get mad about. But
oh, no, you're right.
Maybe
you're right.
I've
gone against my suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
So I should keep moving on.
But there's so much stuff that they do right in this show, too, where it comes down to, I don't know. So I'm not like this big military buff or anything, but I think mm-hmm. a lot of the stuff they do there is interesting. The other thing that
I'm not a military
feel like,
buff, I'm a military fiction buff.
Fiction buff, okay.
I'm not a real life internet, I'm not even an internet badass. I just like reading about other fake badasses.
Okay, that's fair. Good distinction. The other thing that they do really well, and I don't understand why more fucking sci-fi series don't do this, but they do physics so well in this, you know? Like
they do,
They don't do the bullshit where spacecraft fly like planes.
They bank, yeah.
There's no atmosphere
right.
here. We're doing flips constantly.
Yeah.
We can turn around and move the opposite direction
right.
at a moment's notice. They use that really fucking
right.
well, and all the space battle stuff is really good.
Now, I do think it's cool that Star Wars does.
But sci-fi is the only fucking network that can get this right with
yeah.
The Expanse and Battlestar.
Firefly got a fair
amount of it right.
Yeah, I think it's space combat. Now, I agree. They're, the hyper-military realism of the way like combat and space work felt very real and grounded and super cool.
Yeah.
I thought all of the ground-based combat was really shitty.
Like when you have squads of guys going up against Cylons. And,
yeah, it just was really bad. Like the aforementioned rescue mission, where they're going back to get a med kit to save some dude that's dying of radiation poisoning.
think back to Next Generation on that regard.
No, it's Star Trek never.
It's so bad.
Star Trek never said we are the gritty, realistic military science fiction show.
Right, right.
This show did, and like just the gun handling, the tactics, the scenario.
Yeah.
Just you know, fucking Starbuck going in there with a revolver essentially and trying to take down this silo. I mean, I don't know. It's a little bad. How does the concept of who's a Cylon and not a Cylon? How does that not get silly over 4 seasons? Like, it didn't get silly at this point.
Who's a Cylon and not? Just the idea of there are Cylons, like, in the midst?
Because I've noticed in fiction where people can assume other people's identities that you have to use that very carefully and sparingly, or it can get silly. Because we see even in the fandom of Game of Thrones where, like, it gets really fucking silly. Like, mm-hmm. people saying, like, well, since you can be glamored in this, then this guy could be this guy who's actually this girl who actually did this. And it's like... And you can't really...
Well, yeah, I mean, the fandom on it is a little different than the show itself. The show itself, a lot of the times, will just have something more urgent to do.
Okay.
Like, here's a very pressing issue that we have to deal with, and so the Cylon thing is shelved.
Because
for the
it felt like, and maybe it's because of season one, they're introducing all these concepts and are all very much in your face, but it's like, if they didn't pump the brake on that a little bit, it seemed like it would get exhausting.
No, they bring it back when it's important, when they need to do interesting character stuff, but for a lot of it, they kind of don't.
I noticed a lot in the Kobol part one and two, the... shit, what was it called? Something Kobol, goodbye Kobol, hello Kobol.
I don't know.
Learned to stop worrying and love the Kobol.
What
they do
the
stagger
episode?
Zoom.
Oh, they do a lot of
where
camera
time,
stuff
the,
I don't
the,
really
the
like.
The drunk camera swinging, and then like as the chief says three different sentences, it pop zooms in on his face. Like,
yeah.
I notice a little bit, like A Handmaid's Tale does a similar thing where they do the focus moving in and out of the main character. Uh-huh. Like it just kind of pulls, like the camera guys literally just turn into focus wheel. And I found that distracting.
Uh-huh.
Even though I love fancy camera work, but it seems like I love fancy camera work when they're actually trying to make you feel and think a certain way. When it's just like, this is this show's gag. It's just going to be Dutch angles and drunken camera and fucking this weird staggered zoom effect. I found it very, very, very distracting.
So the place that I like it, that it felt almost counterintuitive to use it, but it really worked for me, is out in space. Mm-hmm. Like during the space battles when they got the shaky cam going and they're kind of trying to follow this frenetic action. I really loved
it. If they would have saved it for that, I think that would be cool, because that feels like some kind of embedded press reporter that's trying to catch all the action.
It feels stupid because you're in this vast openness, right? And if you wanted to, you could zoom out and take in the whole thing from a single fixed angle. But they don't. They get in sort of closer, whatever that means in space, and give you kind of a more personal feel there. But where I don't like it is where they do a lot of, this is just a scene of two people talking and the camera is shaking violently.
Yeah.
I really found that distracting.
Oh, I did too.
But it's part of the show's style, I guess.
I also, the other thing that, like, here's another thing I hate about President Roslyn. President Roslyn is keeping her cancer secret.
Yeah.
The fact that a president only has 6 months to live, is highly religious and prone to having prophetic visions, is something that maybe the press should know.
Uh-huh.
And in a scene, like we just established this, that she's keeping her cancer secret, but then she drops a Dama secret about him using Earth as a carrot to Starbuck. I'm like, you son of a bitch!
Yeah.
Like, if I was Adama, as soon as Starbucks started, did you know that the president is having crazy visions because of her brain cancer, and she's got 6 months to live, so she's desperate to try to get, you know, like fucking play that card right back at her. Put her on blast.
Yeah.
Make sure the
that's
whole
that's one
fleet,
of the infuriating things about Russell.
Yeah. Call up the press corps and be like, did you know our president's got 6 months to live? She's dying of cancer, and she's a religious fanatic, and she's seeing visions. "Quote unquote tumor transmissions," like, oh my god, she drives me crazy. Like, even her, in this episode in Kobol Part One, even her chief of staff Billy is like, "You're fucking crazy, lady," and she's still maximum. She's sitting there, stands with her fist, and like, nope, super not crazy.
Billy eventually gets viciously murdered, right?
I don't know. I haven't got that far.
I think he does.
I haven't got that far.
I can't remember. I think he has his guts torn out by a centurion or something.
So, and then I remember the second where I decided not to watch any more Battlestar at the end of part two of Kobol, when Boomer flips her Cylon switch. This robot who's on and maybe it serves the Cylon's ultimate purpose, but she gut shots Obama.
Obama.
She gut shots Adama twice from close range. And I'm like, this is just to have a fucking bullshit cliffhanger. And he's not dead, because if he's going to die, she would have shot him in the head.
Right.
So as a robot, as a Cylon, is there an explanation for why she just didn't assassinate Adama?
I don't think so.
So that's fucking stupid, and that's a dumbass fucking cliffhanger, and I was over this show. And I hope you might disagree with me, and you might say that seasons 2 through 3 make everything worth it, but I hope you understand, as a person in my situation in life who really hasn't changed much, would have lost the patience and decided this, again, great show, lots of big ideas, lots of thrilling science fiction action. It's just not for me.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great show with a few flaws. One of the great things we haven't talked about is the music. It was so different from any of the other, I mean, really anything on TV at the time. It's the first time I heard of Bear McCreary, who came up with this just brilliant drum-based score, this military-feeling score, that then later morphs into this weird Jimi Hendrix-based thing. I don't fucking understand any
also,
of
anytime,
that.
Also, anytime Rosalind starts getting religious, it's a little bit of auto-tuned bagpipey.
Okay. I don't quite remember that.
Kind of like, I don't know. I can't quite explain the music. It's a little bit between auto-tuned bagpipey and generic evil terrorist on 24. You know, like the, I can't, you know what I'm talking about. Anytime they show a Middle Eastern man walking into a mosque on 24, they play the vaguely menacing Middle Eastern man music.
Okay.
And it's the combination of that and auto-tuned bagpipes. That's President Rosalind. I'm getting crazy tumor transmissions from my brain music.
Okay.
But no, I agree. The kind of stuff that's going on during the space battles and during intense military scenes is super cool.
The theme of the show is really good.
Why does Adama's best friend not know how to pronounce his last name? He pronounced Adama interchangeably in this first episode of the second season, which I found was super funny.
Gaius is pronounced Gaius sometimes.
Right.
And
what I get it, like, if you just acquainted with the person,
sure,
but like him to be like, this is Adama's ship and it will be his ship until the day Adama dies, like, you just said it one way, dude. It's the same fucking take. It's, what the hell,
it must be an inside joke with those guys.
Maybe and he's, even though he's dying in the sick bay, he's still taking the piss.
The CG mostly holds up.
By the way,
we
still have a shit ton of feedback, and we're like an hour 30 minutes on this.
Yeah, I got a few more things I want to talk about. So the CG, I think, holds up better than it has any right to from being 15 years ago at this point.
Yeah, totally.
I can't believe that anybody who works on the bridge of Battlestar Galactica could get anything done because of how dark it is. It has, like, the darkest bridge of any sci-fi series ever.
I feel like that's kind of like, you know, like,
it's like a submarine feel to it.
Yes, exactly.
And I understand that. It's this old, antiquated ship that, you know, they're going for a Navy kind of feel. But
yeah. Plus all those, it's crewed exclusively with young people. So they got they got great vision.
Get those eyes.
They eat their carrots.
Yep. But I don't know. We can probably move on to the feedback. I'm sure there's some good stuff to talk about in there.
Yes, let's get the feedback. Jay, Nothing Has Cornerstone Reason Russo says, one of the things the article points out, he actually sent me there's a Nerdist article on the essential 12 episodes of Battlestar Galactica.
Okay.
And I watched essentially the first 5 of those episodes, which was most of the stuff I wanted to watch anyway, because I knew I wanted to watch the miniseries just to make sure I was grounded. I knew I wanted to watch 33 because 33 is where, again, I really like the miniseries other than the President Rosalind, but 33 is where I'm like, ooh, these cracks are starting to widen. And I was going to just, like, start on season 2 and watch 2 or 3 more episodes, but then reading through the synopsis of the Kobol Part 1 and 2, I'm like, oh, no, this is actually going to help me crystallize. But he sent this Nerdist article, the 12 essential episodes, and he says, one of the things this article points out, and I agree with, is the importance of the series finale. It might lack some punch if you haven't seen the whole series, but I'd love to know what you and Jim think of how Ron Moore ended things. I didn't attempt, because I felt like it'd be the height of folly for me to jump to the series finale without understanding anything about the Cylon religion and the resurrection process and all the things that happened. But I thought maybe you could speak to that. Because it seems like you're ambivalent.
I mean, I feel like I already have. Like, I've told you basically the plot of it.
But you're ambivalent about, you've explained it, but, like, you yourself, I feel like you're saying you're conflicted about what that means. And are you surprised mm-hmm. that Jay says that the series finale is essential, or the series finale makes the show?
Yeah, I don't think it. I'll say that I don't think Battlestar Galactica has. Well, it depends on what he means by finale, I guess. Does he mean the final like three episodes? Because that's what it was.
Okay. It says the series finale. I assume that was just a single episode.
But. I mean, if you're talking about like them landing on Earth and reestablishing a civilization accidentally mm-hmm. that is potentially going to re-enslave robot AIs, I feel like that is definitely important.
Right.
Because it's telling you that the cycle is happening all over again with maybe the added twist of things could go differently.
Right.
And like, what is our role in making sure things go differently this time?
Right.
But
well, that also...
I didn't feel like it was as good of an ending, or certainly as satisfying of an ending as like a Next Generation.
Yeah, and that seems like something that Ron Moore would want to say about the real world, that like,
yeah,
are we going to continue this cycle of escalation, provocation, destruction, taking over, bitter feelings leading to provocations, like, or is like there's going to be one point where humanity kind of decides enough is enough? And I get it. It takes two to tango and everything. Mm-hmm. Sometimes one side has to be the bigger side, and someone has to, like, you know what? We have put each other through hell, and it's time to move on for the sake of peace and change. Like, is that, do you think, an adequate statement of what he's trying to get at? Or am I?
I think so.
Reading a little too much into it.
I think so, but here's a flaw in execution, I think, in the finale. It comes down to like these characters being a little schizophrenic. Like, I feel like sometimes they put lines of dialogue in the wrong character's mouth. So for instance, in the final moments of the series, the apparition or whatever of Six looks around at modern day Earth society and says, "Hey, does this remind you of anything?
Shit's fucked.
Look at all this decadence and runaway technology."
Decadence. What the fuck does that mean in that context?
It means Gaius Baltar, I think, like pinstripe suits and sunglasses. I don't know.
Okay.
But yeah, just like all the frivolousness of it and the runaway technology, and then in that same conversation, she turns around and says, "Hey, but we have a chance to change all this." Mm-hmm. Why are you the one who notices and points it out and then has this extended conversation with Gaius who never gives you a counterpoint?
Mm.
You're giving yourself a counterpoint? I guess you're just bringing up the topic, but you're doing it in a way that says you're skeptical that humans will ever change.
Well, also and doesn't even give time, a chance for Baltar to show he's learned anything either.
Exactly. Like, I feel like they put the wrong lines in the wrong character's mouths sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like, you could have an obvious point counterpoint there that would make a lot of sense and would be within, like, a singular viewpoint from each of these characters, but you don't do it. And that's where I kind of, like, lose the thread on a lot of this stuff, is when characters just become a jumbled mess.
Yeah.
And nobody has a solid viewpoint on it, and I can't track it clean. So I don't fucking know, man.
Jeff says, "I hope you comment on how prescient the series was. As technology becomes more networked, the greater the systemic risks."
Okay, sure.
I
can struggle with that.
It's because I was reading an article the other day that says, as much as we're talking about, you know, cyber terrorism and cyber warfare, that our system also has a lot of, like, not even that kind of hacker level risks. Like, it was talking about, like, how much damage you could do at a power substation and an axe. Mm-hmm. Like making you think that, like, man, if we ever have real political unrest in this country, like citywide riots, it could be far more destructive and dangerous than it's ever been before, because we have developed this system of, you know, vast importance of automation, vast importance of electronics, vast importance of energy and power, and yet have done nothing to harden any of the supply lines. It's like having, you know, a military scenario be like you're fighting a war 1,000 miles away from your home base, and yet you're delivering stuff to the front lines in Constantinople wagons on mud roads, you know?
Yeah.
Like, because we haven't had to think about that. So, yeah, I mean, I think about that a lot, how relatively fragile the civilization that we've built largely speaking, for, you know, Western civilization and the, some of the all countries are moving towards this, and how fragile and unprotected it is from any kind of determined assault.
Yeah, I look at the show and I also see how, I guess, short-sighted it is too, because like the idea that these AIs would not be just constantly linked, that they'd be contained in some kind of weird metal bodies.
Right.
That Cylons and Centurions would be a thing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it wouldn't be. It'd just be the Cylon and Centurion consciousness.
Right.
You know, it'd be more like the Borg. It seems almost laughable in the face of something like the Borg, which was done 25 years ago.
Yeah.
30 years ago.
Yeah.
The AI just won't take that form.
I do wish they'd use a little bit of technobabble to salve my science fiction mind about some of this stuff, because you're right. Like, I remember also laughing in the miniseries, they established the fact that these Cylon replicants are biologically indistinguishable from humans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they also have some sort of way to communicate to the home base through subspace.
Yeah.
Do you have a subspace antenna built in? I mean, I haven't seen your butthole or your dick.
I don't talk about that. It's not something I'm really comfortable talking about.
Like that's, I always think it's funny that like Six is seen as super humanly strong.
Yeah.
But she's biologically indistinguishable from a human.
Except her spine lights up when she gets hot.
It's super weird though, right?
it's very weird.
It'd be
like,
okay, like chimpanzees are 5 times stronger than humans.
Uh-huh.
There's biological reasons for that. The tendons are attached to different focal points in their arms. Their muscles are denser. Like, you put them on a scanner, it's right. Like, no one would be like, this chimpanzee body is indistinguishable from ours. Like, that's ridiculous. The fact that...
And at a DNA level...
The fact that you have to die to be able to go home and tell everybody what you know is kind of dumb. I don't know. I wish there was a little bit more thought to the main conceits of the show and making them seem plausible and believable. But I think also, had I been a different person when I sat down in 2009 and watched this, and had they'd been a little bit more fair to the characterization of Rosalyn, I wouldn't be saying this. There's the suspension of disbelief has no longer worked, and I'm nitpicking.
Yeah.
Anubis 21 says, I'd like to hear you guys talk about the heavy emphasis on the religion, especially with the Cylons.
I think we've talked about that.
Do you think
that
it works or just makes them more confusing? You probably won't get to it also, but the first 3 or 4 episodes of season 3 are great, with the occupation of New Caprica by the Cylons and the human resistance. That's what you were talking about, the trial of Baltar, right?
Yes, the early, the instigator for that, sure.
Mm. Cleveland Punk says, what do you guys think about the effect of today's internet fandom would have had on the show if it were currently airing?
There was internet fandom back
then. That's what I'm saying.
And it was a shit show.
I mean, people ask me that about X-Files. Mm-hmm. And I was on the internet when X-Files was on. And, it was Usenet. Everything was going down in Usenet. Now, it's a much smaller segment of a much nerdier community, whereas now you've got lots of different peoples of all types of inclinations and and passions and experiences adding to the conversation. But as long as I can remember, there's always been this kind of fan commentary. I have to go back to like my pre-adolescent to find like, boy, I wish there was someone to talk Star Trek Next Generation with. I wish there was someone to talk Earth 2 with. I wish there was someone to talk Earth Final Conflict. By the time X-Files and beyond, there was always an internet community to do this.
Yeah, there were message boards. I was on some of them.
Right.
There was shipping. Like, all of that stuff happened.
Right.
I will just say for the record that chunky Jamie Bamber is a bad Jamie Bamber. And long-haired Jamie Bamber is the worst Jamie Bamber.
What the hell
Bamber.
Are you talking about?
But long-haired Starbuck is the best Starbuck.
Who's Jamie?
He's Lee.
Oh.
So Lee gets chunky for a while.
Does he?
He goes Charlie
from It's Always Sunny? He adds some mass?
He does. Oh, that's Mac, yeah. He goes Mac for a while.
Add weight.
And then he sheds that, but then he gains it in hair. And it's bad. It's just bad, Jamie.
Yeah, he sewed mass and he harvested hair.
He did. Whereas Starbuck harvests hair and she looks great. So I'm a big fan of long-haired Starbuck.
I haven't seen long-haired Starbuck. I thought short-haired Starbuck was fairly charismatic herself.
Yeah, there's no bad Starbuck, but long hair is my favorite.
Let's see. Also, he says he observes it's... Oh, wait. He goes, would the Reddits of the world have sniffed out the clues as to who the Cylons were? Almost certainly. And in fact, there's got to be, you know, Television Without Pity forums and stuff.
Dude.
Where there's got to be forums where people have historically called that shit.
So I rewatched the All Along the Watchtower episode, which it telegraphs.
Well, there's
it.
Where your Jimi Hendrix comes from.
Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's this fucking weird melding of Jimi Hendrix and Battlestar Galactica
Bear,
at the end, and
Bear
I don't
Creary
get it.
Does that because remember this the final season that we just watched of The Walking Dead where Ezekiel leads the resistance and they he's like, you know what? This guy's a fake king. I'm going to throw some Renaissance fair music in there. I think that's what Bear
does.
He's like, oh, what's the most obvious thematic element? I'm going to grab it and go with it.
Yeah. No, they straight up do a cover. It's this like crazy. Middle Eastern, like I don't even know how to describe it. It's a
so
really cool
the,
cover.
They mix the menacing Middle Eastern man mosque music
and the bagpipes.
With the bagpipes and Jimi Hendrix.
And Jimi Hendrix, and out comes some baffling combination of plot and music that I don't quite get. But
right.
It's interesting. But yeah, they telegraphed the Cylon stuff, and people would have been all over that.
Let's see. Or would the show have to switch things up, etc.? Would there have been a bigger backlash at the ending? As I recall, that was the other thing that kind of cemented that the reputation this show has for kind of falling off the cliff in season four. Because is that a controversial opinion to state that like the fourth season and the ending is weaker than what people were expecting from the first three seasons?
I don't know.
Is that a very is like I'm trying
I
to think is
think
is that
so.
A is that a minority opinion, an extreme minority opinion, or like I'm. Like a moderate position. I
don't really remember like what the vibe was around it.
Because that's
I know that I was left a little consternated by it. I was a little
okay.
confused, but ultimately I think satisfied.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know the history on the show with you, or I didn't know the history on the show with you two. I would have guessed the opposite that you had watched the whole thing and Jim had bailed.
Oh no, I saw the whole thing. I was watching as it was airing.
Maybe you like science fiction a little bit more than me, and I like fantasy a whole lot more than you.
Oh, you, that last half is definitely true.
But I like science fiction a lot.
You do, yeah.
Yeah. Manoj said, I bias very heavily towards Jim's POV here, and so would most of the commissioners, I imagine.
Yeah.
The only thing I'd like to ask is to please try to understand why this show has a crazy cult following quite a bit of the time after it stopped airing. The timing of the show, context of war, the issues it addressed, maybe too many, parenthetically. The incredibly stellar cast, the writing, not sure if some of the weak moments in seasons three or four really detract from the greatness of the show overall. So here again, even a pretty big fan is saying that there are weak moments in seasons three and four.
Oh yeah, I wouldn't deny that.
And I agree, like the writing especially, I don't know about the plotting, but the writing and dialogue and the character moments really shine. And like you get a science fiction show that has a great cast, that has great characters and dialogue, and then you wrap it into mystery box within mystery box. That seems to be the key to have rabid fans.
Yeah.
So the challenge of that is paying it off to where it receives almost universal critical praise. That's much harder to get.
Yeah, and I haven't really talked much about like how good the characters are, but that was one of the biggest hooks for me, was just the relationships between the characters.
I like the made up slurs too and swears.
Yeah,
I wanted to make it more of a thing, but then I was going to go off about like what a brilliant conceit that is to get people dropping motherfuckers on a basic cable show, but then I looked up and Firefly had come out 2 years previously.
Yeah,
and Firefly I think does that
Chinese.
Even more classy.
Yeah,
because frack is essentially just a one-to-one thing for fuck, whereas like you can tell exactly how much swearing the Fireflies guys are doing by how long the Chinese flows.
Right, or how many times they say Goram.
Yeah. So I feel like they get a half star taken away because they essentially just took a concept that really worked on Firefly. Matt from Boston wanted us to put 33 on the required reading list or watching list, which... already going to watch it there, Matt, but we think alike. Strong first episode and really rope into the series after equally strong miniseries. I did a quick rewatch of all three so that I can make better comments. The special effects and thought that went into the set design, space combat maneuvers, and world building were really on display. With any blatantly expository dialogue, the conflicts and struggles of the series are efficiently laid out with action galore. I thought it really stood up after 13 years. I totally agree with all of that.
And that first miniseries is really elegant in its storytelling.
Yeah, one person...
like, tying it all together through Six, like, her physical form, like, yeah. What she looks like, is just a really good way to do it.
Yeah.
To tell, like, a large chunk of that story.
It's funny because one of our commissioners discouraged me from watching the miniseries because he felt like it was some of the weaker moments. Well, and I totally disagree.
Really?
I totally disagree. Like I said, my sole problem with the miniseries was I felt Rosalind was a little thrower waiter, and maybe she needs to be. She's the school teacher, 57th in command.
She's got something to prove
against this admiral who has all the guns. And she, like I said, I don't think it's an unfair. The brinksmanship she's playing is unfair. It's just I wish it was better. I wish she was better written, and I wish McDonald had chosen a little bit of nuance to the role, but I don't know. The space combat is incredible. Flip around and fire while still heading away on inertia. Too many shows, films treat space battles like air battles, cough, cough, Star Wars. BSG battles seem like the type of battles that would really happen in Zero-G. Again, I think Star Wars has its charm. Like, one of the things that you'll never hear me bitch about in The Last Jedi was the bomber sequence, because it continues Star Wars' role of being essentially World War II in space.
Right.
So,
but there's so much cool shit you can do.
Agreed.
With actual space physics.
Agreed. Agreed.
Let's see some of that. Like, if you want that in the modern era, go watch The Expanse.
Yes, The Expanse.
They do some really excellent
stuff.
The
Expanse, I think, is Battlestar perfected. Like, if you want ultra-realistic politics, ultra-realistic looks at... you know, like near future or far future politics and space combat, and it is really, really impressive. Battlestar Galactica is gritty, realistic, action-packed science fiction series. It still has strong character development and mostly well thought out story arcs and mostly realistic character motivations. BSG's spot on the sci-fi world wasn't replaced in my mind until The Expanse came out. There you go.
Yeah. Okay.
There you go. I guess I can't help commenting beyond season one. Overall, I really liked the series, but it seriously faltered as it went on. I would generally give season 1 through 3 positive marks, but the end of seasons 3 and 4 really went off the deep end with a ludicrous and infuriating finale.
Okay.
All right.
So apparently it was super divisive. Yeah.
I am, you know, if the pool of fans that would actually shell out money to hear us talk about it is any indication, even super fans have their quibbles with the show.
Yeah. Certainly.
Devin from Maine, really looking forward to hearing this podcast. I was in high school and college when Battlestar Galactica was on the air and was a huge fan, but when I rewatch these days, I find the experience somewhat lacking. I'm curious if it's simply because I'm older or because I've since watched some truly great television like Breaking Bad, The Leftovers, and Mad Men. I'm excited to hear your thoughts and analysis of BSG. I mean, when I watch especially the first seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation, I have to put on the nostalgia goggles and drink to and there's still like there's probably 10 episodes of Star Trek that are as good as anything that I've seen on television,
and there are 10 that are just unwatchable
bad. laughably ham-fisted and poorly conceived and just bad ideas all around. But that was the thing about episodic television. It's like, well, that episode sucked. Oh, Data's getting a dance next episode. Woo! Like,
right.
I even remember thinking that sometimes. Like, oh, that was kind of a turd, but oh, next week will be better.
And especially, it's harsh because this show, like I said earlier, does have such a good memory for its characters' decisions that when they make decisions that don't seem based within their character,
it's extra
it becomes
jarring.
Part of their character and influences further things later on, and you're like, well, fuck, I didn't like this decision that they made and felt it was out of character. Now they're making more decisions on top of it.
That's one of the charms of episodic television, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, you can course correct so much easier.
For sure.
Than when you've got a season that you can't just pretend didn't exist.
Right.
So, yeah, that's again, it's one of the charms of it. I was hoping that you and Jim would spend a few minutes comparing BSG and Star Trek, especially Deep Space Nine. I know you both are fans of the latter, and Jim, like me, watched Deep Space Nine after Battlestar.
What?
Well, I mean, I think he means you've recently
gone
back.
Oh, I've gone back and watched it. Yeah.
The two shows share a creative source in the form of Ronald Moore, who is a supervising producer of Deep Space Nine and executive producer on Battlestar, and a frequent writer for both. Also, both shows share tropes and themes such as enemies that can disguise themselves as humans, flawed heroes that reluctantly adopt religious mantles, and tactics which should freedom fighters, terrorists use when living under occupation. You know, that's actually... Yeah. That when you put it that way, my God, Battlestar just seems like him wanting to tell a Deep Space Nine without the limits of Star Trek.
Yeah, totally.
Because damn, he's hitting all the themes there. Both shows were format breaking for the time. Battlestar wasn't held back by the limitations of Star Trek universe. There's no Federation governors, no Quark point of view episodes. The characters are allowed to have interpersonal conflicts. Where do you two land on this comparison? Does grittier, more realistic space travel make for a better show? Can a show that was held back creatively be better? Why do you look back on Deep Space Nine more favorably than Battlestar Galactica? Well,
I mean,
again,
we were younger.
And also, like, I think Deep Space Nine was better from the jump than Star Trek The Next Generation was, but there are a lot of the first few episodes before the Dominion War starts that are rough.
I mean, it has one of my most hated
episodes.
Move Along Home. Just a piece of shit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty bad. Yeah,
unqualified.
And yeah, I feel like there's some... Because I was having this debate with people about Star Wars because there's still... Like, it's... You know... I like to try to be understood. There's some people that want to change minds, and like every once in a while someone will offer a different way to look at something that changes a person's mind on how they see something. But more often it's like, well, even if I see your point, still I don't like it. Mm-hmm. Deep Space Nine is, and I use the analogy of like Transformers the cartoon. I love that as an 8-year-old.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Big robots that transformed into supercars and superplanes, and they fought, and it was cool. And a little boy was like fighting alongside the heroes. That's awesome. I go back and watch that. I recently watched as a mid-30s, and it's shit.
Yeah,
the Transformers cartoon is shit. Mm-hmm. Compare and contrast to Star Wars, which I loved as a kid, and I watched A New Hope, and I'm like, that's not a shitty movie.
No,
that's a great piece of American filmmaking.
Yeah.
I think Deep Space Nine is closer to Transformers, and Battlestar, if you can overlook its flaws, is much closer to Star Wars.
Okay. I would agree that I think Battlestar is a better made show. I don't quite have the same nostalgia for it because I didn't see it when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And if it had been reversed, I would absolutely love Battlestar far more than Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
But I have such a built-in nostalgia for that show. And it was a truly great show for its time. Like you said, format busting. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know that a Star Trek show could be about a war between the Dominion with the Klingons. But like, I always felt like Star Trek was this exploration thing primarily. And it became more about like the battle of the Federation trying to... you know, remain against this power that was almost unstoppable.
Well, also we revisited Babylon 5 a year ago, 2 years ago. And I feel like that's a forgotten science fiction franchise because the special effects are terrible.
Yes.
But I sometimes wonder like if the effects, but not as bad as I thought they were. I wonder if it had like the effects of even Deep Space Nine, if it wouldn't be better than all these shows we're talking about. But
was that a sci-fi show?
No, that was a syndicated like on Paramount or VPN or VP. What was that? The Paramount Network, Viacom, VPN was
UPN.
UPN. Thank you.
Wow. Okay.
But
am I thinking of Farscape? Is that what I'm thinking of?
You might be.
Okay.
You might be. Yeah.
Or the Kevin Sorbo one.
Sure.
Which one was that?
Andromeda.
Andromeda, yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of piece of shit. my way is like, I feel like these are like Pokemon. Deep Space Nine is the level one Pokemon. It evolved to Battlestar, which has then achieved its final form in The Expanse.
Okay. That's cool. I like that.
Because, like, I feel like if you could see that, like, I think it's easy to see in his feedback that Battlestar is kind of Ronald Moore's perfection and distillation of the things that worked in Deep Space Nine, and I think the Expanse is even taking the ball further because I forget who the chief diplomat of the UN is. She's got like a really elaborate name, but she is a much better version of what they're trying to get at with President Rosalyn.
Her accent throws me every time.
But her characterization, like
absolutely,
whenever she
absolutely
takes a strong stand
right.
against someone, yes. like it's the universe seems like it's full of smart people that have really good points, and they enter and they're not cocksure and full of themselves, and the ones that are appropriately seen as foolish and dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I viewed the whole thing. Anyway, Jesus, even if you didn't like my I think I kept it to much less than 25% of the cast was me bitching about Battlestar.
Oh yeah.
And it's a 2-hour podcast, so y'all got your money's worth.
You sure did.
I hope you guys enjoyed it.
And I watched like 7 hours of Battlestar for this, so I put a lot of effort
right,
into
it. And I watched more than I normally would because I was self-conscious, you know? I don't like disappointing people
right.
that commission podcasts, so...
that just feels bad for everybody.
Yeah.
And I wish, like, after watching these 8 episodes or whatever I watched, I wish I could go back and watch the whole thing before we did this podcast. Just no time to do it.
Sure. Or I wish I had...
Because I felt like I was back in 2006, you know, watching season 3 of this thing.
And it does
going,
seem like
yes.
some of the meatier stuff with the religion and politics would have been interesting, even flawed as it was, would have
oh,
had
a weekly
a lot
show
more discussion.
On this thing
yeah.
would have been so much fun.
And it would have been cool if I had more background to be able to go back and, like, rewatch the finale and give a better answer of how I feel about that. But I just didn't. And I probably I'm not going to.
Real quick, one other thing before we get out of here that as a podcaster I would be remiss not to mention that I thoroughly enjoyed at the time when I was watching Battlestar Galactica is Ron Moore's podcast about it. He actually did like a commentary style podcast for a lot of the episodes. I don't think it was every episode of Battlestar Galactica, but a lot of them.
When you say commentary, you mean he just talked about the making of, or was he talking about fan theories, or... Because I could see that going a lot of different ways.
It was less like fan theories. It was more about like production and themes. Like he would get into like what were we thinking when we wrote this part of it, you know? Mm. What were we trying to say with this? It's actually really, really interesting. And he would also do like, oh, here's where, I don't know, Adama broke his legs, both of them, and we had to stop filming for 5 weeks. That didn't happen, but...
Were they released like... the week of the episode come out, or were like the whole season drop and then a retrospective?
No, it was like it was kind of like we do.
So there's
with
no
our
spoilers
podcast.
Go looking forward or looking back or anything like that. Interesting.
No, but it was really, really cool. And it had this great atmosphere too, where it was like him in his home office just sitting there with a glass of whiskey, and you could hear like the ice rattling around.
Was there anyone else with him ever? Did he like have like other...
I think he had some other production guests from time to time, but it was such a cool thing. To be able to get like almost real time, this real time commentary from somebody who was
it kind of puts in perspective the other commissioner's question about what if this show were released in the internet savvy era, like Ron Moore was doing a podcast. I probably there was a community consuming it, so
I was part of it. Yeah,
yeah. So there you go.
I really think that's worth listening to.
So. That's the commission podcast for Battlestar. We're going to continue to try to catch up on the queue as best as we can. We got a little bit of a lull in the content. I'm not sure what's coming out next because we got a commissioner who's kind of wavering about what project they want us to work on. So we might have to shuffle some things around. But there'll be more stuff coming out, and the schedule looks pretty fun and pretty cool from what I can tell. So we'll be back. With another one real soon.
Yeah.
And until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
See ya.